Life's Third Act is a podcast dedicated to helping you get the most out of your retirement. Sponsored by Tucker Allen, attorney CPA Joe Cordell features guests each week to discuss prominent topics for those over 55. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Life's Third Act. We continue our series of learning from the mistakes of others, others who tend to be famous or infamous or both. And Marley does a marvelous job of identifying people that she thinks we would be interested in learning about, and then people where there's an object lesson for us. So there is some pleasure just in some interest we have in celebrities generally.
Yeah.
And there's kind of a perverse pleasure in, you know, the mistakes of others. Sometimes we, you know, we think, oh, I didn't make that mistake. So we think that this is a great series. We want to continue it for some period of time. So let me say this, because I always forget to mention this to you guys. Please hit the like button if you enjoy this and at all. And also subscribe. Subscriptions are huge. And comments. Comments, believe it or not, help us in ratings. I'm learning about this. comments help us in ratings as much as a like. I didn't know that. So please give us feedback and whatnot. We do hope that you benefit from this and enjoy it as well. So Marley, this week we're going to talk about a name familiar to all of our viewers. Do you want to launch it?
Yeah. So this week we're going to talk about Jimi Hendrix. You know, we all know him as the famous guitarist, the Jimi Hendrix Experience. And yeah, so we're going to get into all of that and how he died without a will.
Given my age versus yours, I think I probably know more about this topic.
You probably do, yes.
I would be very impressed, incidentally, if it turned out that you knew a whole lot about Jimi Hendrix.
I know his music. I know a little bit of his career. He had a really short career, that four-year span when he was like super famous. But that's about it. So you probably know a little bit more in the details than I do.
But I thankfully, you've done the research on him.
Yes.
So I can just make comments from my experience, from my youth. But, you know, you mentioned that the fact that he had this incredibly short career. And those of us who've been hearing his name and listening to his music, I have since I was a young teenager. Mm-hmm. It's hard to believe we're talking about really 4 years.
Yeah, it's crazy. I was doing the research and I had to double check because I knew he had a short career, but then I saw the number and I was like, really, only four? That's insane. He did so much in such a little span of time.
Yeah, he really shot out of the gate. Mm-hmm. Give us a little background on his upbringing or where he's from.
Yeah. So in 1942, he was born in Seattle, Washington, and he grew up playing guitar, and he kind of drew some inspiration from blues legends. And then in the early 1960s, he worked as a background guitarist for Little Richard, Tina Turner, a lot of bigger names. But mm-hmm. it wasn't until 1964 when he relocated to New York. He started playing in coffee houses. And then Chas Chandler, who is the bassist for The Animals, found him. And he was like, I can do something with this guy.
He saw this potential.
Yes. So he took Jimmy under his wing and they traveled to London in 1966. And that is when they hit off that Jimi Hendrix Experience tour.
Yeah, it's real interesting how you would think that blues, which one would say confidently was born in the mm-hmm. United States, particularly in the South, in the black community. But interestingly enough, when you look at rock history, the early young all-white musicians in England were the ones who really saw the talent and really they grasped blues music in a way that America was much slower to do,
mm-hmm.
the white community in America.
Mm-hmm.
So you had all these people like Rolling Stones were just fanatical about blues music, black blues music. Mm-hmm. And they were listening to Muddy Waters and Wolf.
Howlin' Wolf.
I mean, there are all these names that were legendary in blues, but it wasn't so much in the broader white community in the United States that it was was recognized. Now, some would say, well, Elvis early on, no doubt, Elvis was hugely influential. And we had Chuck Berry, and so we definitely had some people that I've read were role models also of Jimi Hendrix. But there wasn't that hunger and that appreciation, that fervor that there was among many young rock stars to be in London at that time, especially London, but England generally.
Strong roots are essential for a healthy tree, especially your family tree. That's why you work hard to take care of your family every day. At Tucker Allen, we know that taking care of your family means planning for the future. Our team provides personalized estate planning to help you protect your family, your legacy, and your future. From wills and trusts to long-term care and estate planning, count on Tucker Allen, personalized estate planning made simple.
Not surprisingly, Charles apparently took, he was the bass player of Herman's Hermits.
Yes.
Yeah, he took him to London, and all of a sudden, you know, he hits it big.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was almost like overnight success because they released Purple Haze and Foxy Lady, like right in all of that. And that was just what they blew up from.
Yeah. And Hey Joe, I think, was a big hit.
Yes. Hey Joe was also, that was one of his biggest songs. I think that was his first biggest song.
Though all three of those and two others, at least, climbed way high on the charts in the UK. Now, this is before it was appreciated in America. So really, it's interesting that London recognized Jimi Hendrix's talent and the UK did before the US did. But then when he came back from London, he already was a star. He had already been, you know, he had met people who looked up to him already, like the Stones, Keith Richards in particular, and others. These people that young American kids at the time who were fans of rock music were looking up to these people in London, the Beatles too, but the Beatles were less influenced by blues than a number of the other artists that we came to know, you know, Led Zeppelin and others. So these guitarists that American kids tend to look up to and musicians in the UK were at that time when they met Hendrix, they were looking up to Hendrix. So they'd already celebrated him when he was in London. And then when he comes back here, naturally.
He's huge.
Yeah, he's huge. He did some performances that really surged his career.
Yeah, their first one when they got back here was at the Monterey Pop Festival. And that was just kind of what hit it off in the U.S. And then everybody knew, you know, his name and who he was. And
so by the time he rolls into Woodstock, he had done Isle of Wight, I think, and
yes,
a couple other big shows.
Yeah, that's correct. And then, yeah, then he got to Woodstock and, you know, he was already a huge name. So everybody was waiting for it.
Yeah, I mean, so we think of him as kind of bursting on the scenes and to sudden success. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it is true. I mean, he was, what, early 20s?
Yeah.
So by the standards of success in any other profession, that's meteoric.
Yeah.
You don't get to become great as a lawyer or a doctor or you know, almost every other profession when you're 21 or 22. You've got to prove yourself. But the neat thing about the arts in many ways, and especially music, is, you know, you can soar to the top very quickly.
Yeah, if you have that talent, you have that talent. And it's kind of crazy that he went from playing, you know, guitar for bigger names and never really made any huge connections with that. And it wasn't until he was playing in New York coffee houses that somebody found him and they were like, wow, this, you know, this kid's got it.
Yeah. Yeah. It is funny how that works. It's, you know, it's almost like serendipity. It's just hard to figure out what is the formula where you get discovered. And some suggest that there's just this luck quality, that it's not enough to be truly great and good. It doesn't guarantee in music that you're discovered. I think there's some truth in that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he had earned some dues. A little bit interesting thing that I didn't know, and I was looking at this last night I was looking at this topic, and I didn't know that Hendrix had been in the military. When I think of the military and Jimi Hendrix,
farthest from each other, yes.
I think of Star Spangled Banner, that his version, which I don't think would have been approved by the military. And I don't know that it was intended to be unpatriotic, but it definitely was unorthodox.
Yes.
So anyway, he did, I think he volunteered for the military. Mm-hmm. And my understanding was there was concern about a draft that was coming. But I don't know what his motivation was. But he wasn't in the military very long.
No, it was only like a year or two. It wasn't
very long at all.
Yeah.
But he was not, for the record, he was not dishonorably discharged, mm-hmm. though he was discharged, but it was honorably. There's a category where the Army just concludes that you are not going to be a good soldier. You know, it's not dishonorable, but they just conclude that they're like four or five categories by which you can leave the military. And you know, most is under honorable. But in his case, I think that there was an officer who just turned in a report that said, look, there's nothing we can do that's going to get his interest in the Army. I think it's best if we send him on his way, something like that. And apparently what he had been doing during this 2 years or so was he had been even more obsessed with guitar than he had been when he went in. And still, I guess we'll never know maybe why he chose to join the military, if he joined. And he did join. Yeah. But the question is, I think he may have voluntarily joined. I don't think the draft was in effect at that time.
No, it wasn't in effect. My kind of thinking behind that is he probably hadn't broken into his, like, you know, career as a guitarist yet and didn't really think he could make anything from it. So he was like, okay, the Army's my option. And if there's a draft coming, you know, I'm going to get drafted anyway. And then when he went in, that's when he had that, not necessarily downtime, but I mean, when you're in the military, you've got those periods that you have to fill. So what is he going to fill that with? Guitar.
Yeah. So since he was born in 42, he would have been 18 and 60. And in 60, there's a whole lot going on in music. So I don't think that he knew the doors that were going to appear for him between 60 and 62 and 63, when all these groups were starting to emerge and instrumentalists and guitar was starting to get more attention. So my suspicion is that he always saw it as simply a way to earn a living.
Yep.
He didn't have credentials other than that, no college degree. And then he gets in there and he becomes persuaded. He was performing, incidentally, in the Army.
Yes, yeah.
So that was a factor, I'll bet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I bet there's a lot of people. So if you're familiar, this is a brand new artist, but if you're familiar with Zach Bryan, he's a country artist. He was in the Navy for about 8 years, and they honorably discharged him just so he could go to his music career. So I'm kind of wondering if it was something along those lines, too, that they saw, oh, you know, he could be something. So we're going to.
That's an interesting take. Mm-hmm. I prefer that explanation. In other words, it probably is true that he wasn't showing much interest, and he probably did want to move on. But I like to think that this officer who wrote this report had good intentions, that he wasn't saying, look, this guy's a waste of our time and suggesting everybody else's time.
Yeah. In the 60s, I don't think they wanted to lose anybody, probably.
No. So yeah. I like that idea, and it makes sense because he had started performing in the military at various events, whatever they call these clubs, and was wildly popular. So people could tell this guy had a great deal of talent. And also, many people don't realize that he had done some studio work. And so a lot of people underappreciate studio musicians. But, I mean, Duane Allman, a lot of the biggest names, Jimmy Page, were people who started out in studios. And to be a studio musician requires somebody to be extremely versatile. Mm-hmm. They have to be very quick to be able to have, you know, on a Monday, somebody comes in and they want to do, you know, some sort of easy listening music or something that's dramatically different. Another shows up to do folk and another rock and jazz. I mean, there's so many variations and types of music. And a musician is called upon to have the versatility to where they don't want to replace you and have to say, oh, he's our blues guy or he's our jazz guy. Instead, they want a musician that's going to be paid to whatever comes in the door. They can look at if there is music, they can read the music. And in the early days, I don't know if this is true today, but a lot of these guys couldn't read music. So really it was their ability to just immediately, like Duane Allman, his ability to, he would listen to the song. And he would pick it up just like that. And so Jimmy Page Jimmy Page as well as Jimi Hendrix and all of the Yardbirds guitarists back to did studio work. And it says a lot about Hendrix. That's
yes.
a great training ground. I'm sure however long he did that, mm-hmm. and he mixed it with playing backup and traveling mm-hmm. with some of these other musicians. Yeah, I don't think that he was a very good guy that's going to be in the background.
Yeah, I was about to say, he went from big name to big name, but I think it's just because, you know, he wanted to be in the spotlight, so that's probably why.
Yeah.
He wanted his in to get out.
Yeah, and his unique way of playing was,
yeah.
you could tell that he was untutored, and mm-hmm. you know, sometimes the best musicians are ones who figure it out on their own, and he didn't have the luxury of being in a music academy and being
yes.
taught, you know, what is the traditional or classical way to do things. Instead, he's left-handed, so he plays this, learns to play the guitar upside down.
Yep, yeah.
I mean, it's the weirdest-looking thing, and and clearly this guy figured it out on his own.
He really wanted to. Yeah. When I think about him and Tina Turner, I'm like, those two worlds don't mix that well. It's just a very strange, it would be very odd to have seen him as a backup guitarist for her.
Yeah. So people who tend to be a little judgmental, and in my older age, this is me too, is I look at people who's kind of spend their lives, waste their lives, and they die, or maybe they lose all their money, and mm-hmm. maybe they end up in jail. Just some unhappy ending for somebody who starts out with such talent. They're charging out of the gate. They're 18, 20, 25, whatever. They're very young, and they're incredibly successful, and they blow it. So in my older age, my tendency is to just think about the many bad decisions. But the reality is that until you've been in the shoes of having Hendrix went from nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And now there are some people who in his shoes would say, okay, I have something now and I'm going to be careful. But his personality was such that, and the personality of many of us would be such that if we go from nothing to being thrust into a world where we're idolized, worshipped, I mean, from what was regarded as a loser, quote unquote, to a person that's worshipped,
mm-hmm.
You know, I can understand how a 20-year-old may not handle it well at all, and whereas that same person maybe, not necessarily, but that same person, their 40-year-old self would probably have made better decisions. We don't know whether Hendrix would have made better decisions as a 40-year-old.
Yeah,
but there was the addiction to drugs, and you'll talk a little bit about his
yeah.
death.
Yeah, so he passed away on September 18th of 1970. He was only 27. He died of asphyxiation, and it was, you know, kind of due to the drugs that he was doing and the partying and all of that stuff.
I guess we should have it. It means that he threw up.
Yes.
And we weren't going to dwell on this. It's a little gross, but he was on his back, and
mm-hmm.
and it happens with drug overdoses.
Yeah. Really often. And so, you know, he passed away, but he died without a will. He wasn't prepared at all. And it's kind of sad because, I mean, we'll get into it, but his name, he died with only $20,000 in his bank account, but his name has made him so much money since that I just wish, you know, we both wish that he could have
yeah.
had the foresight of that.
And nobody's going to be surprised to hear that this person we're talking about died without a will.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, he should have had a will. And the fact that he was young, you know, we still... in his circumstances, he was on his own. He didn't have people around him that really were taking care of him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who didn't have conflicts of interest. I think for him, there maybe was no such person, perhaps in his family, probably in his family, but definitely outside his family. These people cared about him in his music. I'm convinced of that. Many people cared about him in that way. But the people who are handling the money, there were conflicts of interest, and Hendrix had no hope, given where he'd come from, where he was in life, his emotional condition, the speed with which he was thrust into the position. There was just no opportunity to get up to speed on mm-hmm. on the right decisions to make. So, as we might imagine, you know, Hendrix was showing up at performances. He was doing recordings. He was, you know, going around and private planes and cars. And so I doubt he was even asking, you know, how much money do I have at this point?
Yeah. I definitely think that was the case. And I think, you know, even if he knew that, maybe in his mind he was like, well, what's the purpose of a will if I'm only passing on $20,000? Because I know you mentioned like his family. He was close with his brother Leon, but not really anybody else. I know they had a good relationship, but he was probably thinking like, okay, well, he probably wasn't even thinking I'm going to die. But if that thought ever crossed his mind, he was probably like, okay, well, it'll just go to him. That's just, you're 27. That's the way that you think.
Yeah. And you would know that better than I would. But yeah. I mean, I've forgotten. but no, I think you're absolutely right. And we'll talk a little bit about the family members. But I wanted to kind of set the stage here. So remember, it was very quick. I mean, when you talk about meteoric, this is about as meteoric as it gets. Mm-hmm. A four-year period where he's made hit rock music history, and he did it in that short period of time. And so we should also mention, too, that he has since received lots of awards. This will tie into, you know, the value of the estate, mm-hmm. is that Rolling Stone has consistently rated him among the best guitar, I mean, the top 10. And I think one year, I may have read this, you can check me on this, I think they had him as number one guitarist in one year in rock history.
Yeah.
So, but he's always at the very top of the list, toward the top. And virtually any magazine that has done rankings and ratings of music, Guitar Player magazine has consistently, so he's made a mark in music history. All Along the Watchtower, people think that All Along the Watchtower was, some people think Jimi Hendrix wrote it. It's a Bob Dylan song, but Hendrix owns that now, mm-hmm. in the sense that people think of it with that electrification that he brought to it. So he created history in this 4-year period, and he's had a lot of staying power in terms of popularity.
Yeah.
Who would have thought that that any of these guys, of these greats of that period, would have such longevity with successive generations? But there are young people who listen to his music now and watch videos and, yep. and study his life and study his guitar style. There are articles regularly in like Guitar Player and whatnot. I play guitar a little bit. Not anything that I want to mention in the same subject as Jimi Hendrix. But I say this to say that when I pick up magazines about guitar, there are still articles being written for mainly young readers about how Jimmy Page or Jimi Hendrix, choose your example, but Hendrix's name specifically is regularly appearing, more than even like a Jimmy Page or an Eric Clapton, believe it or not. There are several that, I just named a few who really are very popular, but Hendrix, I would argue, there's really almost more about him in a number of those magazines than these other great guitarists, mm-hmm. of his era, incidentally. So he continues to have this huge fan base and to influence music today. And so he, of course, didn't foresee any of this. And so, as you said, he dies this tragic death. He's age 27, mm-hmm. 1970, not long after Woodstock. Janis Joplin was another fatality not long after Woodstock. Wasn't she 27?
She was somewhere around there, yeah. I think she, yeah.
All member of the 27 Club, Kurt Cobain, and I think the Doors. What's his name from the Doors? Jim Morrison, I think.
Really? Yeah. What is this about age 27?
That's scary.
Anyway, so I'm kind of setting the stage that we're not surprised the person we just described did not have a will. But we want to communicate to you, you know, the magnitude of that mistake, and then show some parallels for all of us. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about what happens after his death.
Yeah, so obviously, you know, he passes, he's without a will, and he passes in London. So this is kind of going to be, you know, under their laws and how that all goes. But basically how it works in London is his estate's management will, you know, it became like really complex, and intestacy laws, it got all passed down to his father instead of anybody else in his family. So I guess not passed down, passed up, like you were saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that when we use the word intestacy, what we're talking about is when you die without a will, then what's going to govern is intestate laws. Now, it's possible that, first of all, if there had been a will, it would have been governed by the state in which it was done. Just because he died in London, had he done estate planning, it would have been honored under, you know, we have international treaties that are intended to assure that these laws are respected. Mm-hmm. So, but I will say in this case, the intestate laws, which ours are derived from England, quite frankly, from hundreds of years ago, and they've not changed a whole lot since then, except as it relates to things with marriage and divorce. But other than that, the basic assumptions about what people would otherwise want to do with their stuff are very similar. So in Hendrick's case, there was no wife, no children that was known of.
Nobody.
He had no children. No. That's a little surprising.
I know. But I guess, his career was only 4 years.
Yeah, but...
He was touring the whole time. But I know.
Rock like artists any, run around yeah. and... I'm just surprised that there weren't children.
There was nothing, no.
So anyway, so he dies, and the intestate laws, and this kind of makes sense. If you die without a will, and you have no children, you don't have a wife, then it's probably going to all go, depending on your state, will all go to a living parent. So you may say, well, what if I have a brother? Why wouldn't it go to brother? Well, if you think about what's more probable— You're more likely to have a good relationship with your parents than really a sibling, even though many of you are thinking, well, no, my sibling I'm closer to than anybody in the world. And some of us are that way. I'm close to my brother. But in terms of creating these laws, I think that it was thought that it made more sense to have it go to a parent. And probably there's thinking that, and if you do want to go to your sibling, then that parent who has the same relationship with that child as with, you know, you, the deceased child, then one could argue, well, it's going to end up in the hands of a sibling. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it goes to a sibling, the parents may be without money in their older age. And that sibling, you can be less confident the money's going to go up from that sibling to a parent than it would that from a parent to go down. Mm-hmm. So whether you agree with it or not, that's one of the common assumptions.
Yeah, and I think if you think about it, you know, just in London, those laws were set in place like years and years and years ago. So parents, they're the head of the household. That's everything. It doesn't matter if, you know, you're the child or anything like that. They have control of everything. So I think that's where it kind of, you know, derives from also.
Yeah. That's a big factor. Mm-hmm. So in this case, it's not a terrible thing, I don't think, except that, as you mentioned, Hendrix was close to his brother Leon.
Yes, that's correct. They were very close, and he didn't have the greatest relationship with his father, Al. And his father, Al, actually had an adopted daughter, Janie Hendrix, that he obviously adopted. And what kind of ended up happening was that Al took the estate and essentially removed Leon from it and bequeathed it all to Janie whenever he passed.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting is the value of the estate when Hendrix died was what? It was like...
$20,000, and now in today's money, it is $175 million.
So this goes to show you. Now, some of these things you may think, well, how is this an analogy to me? It's true that the examples we've been given recently, where there's what lawyers call intellectual property, that's all this stuff relating to copyright, image, likeness, all those things. So we're going to continue to have examples of that as being a part of the estate when we're doing famous people, mm-hmm. almost by definition. But it's still, there's still something for us all to learn, because if you think about it, what this is a business. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it's a business that requires some skill to run. So, you know, some of us may think, well, gee, I own a construction business. And yeah, that requires skill to run. And I can't just, you know, have that without a plan passed to my children or others without losing a ton of its value. And that's true. A business, if you don't plan its succession correctly, it plunges in value. Well, the same thing is true whenever you're thinking about you know, what will be the value of someone's marketability in the future, of their recordings, of their image and likeness, T-shirts, you know, mugs, a restaurant that has a name or a bar. I mean, all those ways in which Jimi Hendrix's names have, just think how many ways his name has been used. And to not have a plan, and in fairness, we're talking about a kid here when he died, so you know, it just, there was no plan, and that means that his dad was not equipped to do it. So his dad tried to keep track of it for a while, but he was taken advantage of by Hendrix's manager at the time.
Yes, Leo Branton, who was also the estate like lawyer. So in, if we want to get into the lawsuits, in the 1993 lawsuit, Al Hendrix initiated it against the former lawyer, and he accused him of engaging in like questionable sales of the image and Jimmy's name and so on and so forth. And this was just because there was no LLC at the time to cover all of that. There was no umbrella company over his name, his image, copyrights, anything.
Yeah, so, you know, I just cringe to think at the details, which I don't know the details. I'm not sure anybody does. And I don't want to say that I know that this lawyer is guilty of, you know, these things that were alleged. But I will say that that really Al Hendrix was not in a position to protect what he had inherited. Mm-hmm. And so there were a lot of several sales that took place where purportedly the song rights were sold. And later, like less than a decade later, or about a decade later, then there's additional lawsuits where Al tried to recover it, saying, I didn't consent to that. Mm-hmm. And it was just a, you know, it's very messy, and it involves international institutions that people formed offshore that owned the rights at one time. And Al said, no, I understood, and I believe he was told that he was just renting the use, which you can do. You can allow people to use publication rights or use an image, and they pay you rent, essentially, mm-hmm. royalties. So he was insistent that he didn't sell, you know, the song book. And in reality, I'm sure he didn't, but he had to go to court and prove it. Mm-hmm. So it was an ugly legal fight. So he finally, he held it together, but it was a rickety thing. I mean, I know there were all sorts of violations occurring. This is, contrast this picture with how Priscilla and the one or two other professional trustees came in and how she guarded vigilantly mm-hmm. Elvis's memory, all the intellectual property associated with him. She was on top of it. And she had professionals that assured that it was handled correctly. And there was, you know, if you do something with Elvis's name, even in the 80s, you would hear about it. And you would get a letter, a cease and desist letter, et cetera. So that's the way it should be done. And Hendrix, you know, he didn't have the knowledge or the skill to plan, to know to plan his estate, much less to develop a plan. But professionals should have been in his ear, should have been tugging on his sleeve, mm-hmm. saying, look, you need to take 30 minutes and think, or an hour or two. We need to meet and talk about this and have some sort of plan. So it ends up in his dad's hands, and his dad, in fairness, had no history managing businesses, much less complicated things like this. So I know there was tons of waste over the years, and it's a great to for us to know that the value of the estate today, which I think is in the hands of Joan?
Janie, his
Janie.
Sister, yeah.
Yeah, so we're talking about you know, $175 million is an estimate. It could be more, but I guarantee you this, it's not worth what it could have been.
Yeah.
And furthermore, a lot of the money that should have come in over those decades, it was sprinkled around the world, and I suspect nobody sent cease and desist letters. Mm-hmm. So there have been a lot of copies made, bootleg copies of the recordings that are out there. You know, the analogy for us here is that it's like any business. You know, if you don't make a plan for how your children, who will run a business for your children, manage real estate, whatever those things are, then it will dissipate and it will lose its value. and ultimately become worthless. Mm-hmm. So the lesson is, you know, even if your children don't have the ability to run a business, for example, or to manage real estate or to manage other assets that you might have, there are professionals who do that. And that was the answer in this case, not for Leon to be able to do this or his daughter to be able to do this. It was for them to know, for this to have been placed in a trust and for them to have been in a position perhaps to sit as a co-trustee, mm-hmm. but to be subject to these professionals. And not that professionals can't screw things up. They can. But the point is they're insured. You know, they're often with trust departments of big banks. So you have lawyers involved looking over their shoulders. So it's a much more reliable way. And there's accountability for, you know, the heirs down the line, what we call the remainderman in a trust, future generations. Mm-hmm. It's a trust can be a marvelous tool by which this could have been managed much better and the family would have had a lot. Talk a little bit about what's gone on with Janie on the one hand, who, remember, is the adopted daughter of Al, and Leon. They've not had a happy relationship.
No. So in 2002, Al died, which means that Janie got everything. And between all of that time, obviously, there had been those couple of lawsuits with Jimmy's name and his copyright, and they formed the Hendrix Experience LLC to cover all of that. So Janie was in charge of that. And in 2009, she actually went after Leon and his business partner for trademark infringement. I'm not sure. I couldn't find a lot of details on what exactly that meant or, like, you know, how they were using it. But she did win that, and they took it all the way to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. So that went, you know, very far. And from there, she's kind of just had to fight everybody off of his name, off of his copyright, his image.
And is she still living, do we think?
Yeah, she's still living. Okay. So all the way up to 2016, when the Purple Haze liquor lawsuit happened. So there was a Purple Haze liquor, obviously inspired by a song, but they didn't create that. It was some other company. So she had to go and fight that. And there hasn't been anything since that. So hopefully people are, you know, getting the word that you can't use his name without paying royalties. But she's been protecting it. And then as far as Leon, he kind of fell off the map. He is still alive, but he just dropped the argument, essentially. There wasn't really anything he could do about it, unfortunately. And that's the thing is, you know, we don't know if Jimmy wanted that. And that's the issue without having a will. How do we know that he wanted it to go to Janie?
In defense of Leon, is if it's true that he's the one who had this, he alone had this great relationship with Jimmy, I doubt he had a relationship with Janie. I mean, she had been adopted. She had been actually a stepdaughter, I understand, before the adoption. So the stage is kind of set for conflict here. So Al dies, what year?
It was 2002.
Yeah, so 2002. And maybe then is when Leon really discovers what the distribution plan is or the will is. There was a will that Al had. So immediately there's conflict. Leon has this genuine belief that this is not what Jimmy would have wanted. So though there's a lot of litigation with Leon over a period of years between these two step siblings, still it is, I shouldn't say step or half. I guess say half legally.
Yeah.
So this consumed a lot of assets, a lot of time. Leon, you know, I think, felt this righteous indignation. So he was determined to go ahead and apparently do things with the name and likeness. Mm-hmm. And he felt entitled to this, I'm sure, morally, if not legally. So these two children battled each other. And a lot of money was spent, but it has held up, though, that Janie is the one who owns, you know, this intellectual property, and has done a reasonably good job under the circumstances of holding it together. But there's just been, again, coming back to how easy this could have been. It a lot of this could have been prevented, and I'm sure this estate could have been worth a lot more than it is today. But $175 million is not anything to...
No, not from 20,000. And I'm sure, it would have been so nice seeing them work hand in hand, because I think for Leon, it wasn't a money thing. It was a this is my brother kind of thing. And so it would have been nice to see them, you know, supporting the Hendrix name and making sure that Jimmy's legacy lived on. But...
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we didn't get
that. And the amount that these siblings spent
in
attorney fees. I mean, to go up to the Court of Appeals on this litigation, I mean, there was a lot of money spent from the estate, from the value of this LLC that was created, the Hendrix Experience. Who knows how many hundreds of thousands, probably millions were spent given to lawyers in this litigation. But it was necessary at that point in order to be able to gather around these rights that have been distributed among various entities by record labels as well as these managers, quote unquote. So Al had his hands full at a time when he didn't expect this, and Janie stepped into the battle, and she had to continue to battle. But some of that will always be necessary, incidentally. It's part of the business. But in this case, it wouldn't have been nothing like what they endured, nor the amount of infringement that happened that was never enforced. So anyway, that's Jimi Hendrix. There are lessons learned, I hope, from this discussion. So this has been another episode of Life's Third Act. Till next time, take care.
You've been listening to Life's Third Act, a podcast for thriving in retirement. Sponsored by Tucker Allen, your estate and elder law advisors. Each week we discuss topics and answer questions to help you better plan for your future. For more information, visit TuckerAllen.com. Subscribe and listen again next week for another edition of Life's Third Act. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.